welcome back to Back in My Play. This is episode number 33. For this episode, we're going to be talking about Bonk's Revenge on the TurboGrafx-16 and also the PC Engine. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and of course, we have back on the show, after talking about Bonk's Adventure, Steve Lin from Gree Games. Steve, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we got like crystal clear audio quality. Like, you're in the brand new conference room of your office. It sounds great.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to improve the experience for everybody. So really trying hard this time.
So, and we're also very lucky to have on, and I think this is via you talking to Frank Cifaldi, who then recommended Brandon Sheffield, who I'm very happy to announce is on the recording from, of course, insertcredit.com. They have a great podcast over there. And also necrosoftgames.com. And you can get him on Twitter at necrosofty on Twitter. Brandon, how's it going?
Going all right. Glad to be here talking about Bonk. It's a subject that I very much enjoy.
I've had some intel from your kind of impressions of the game, so it's going to be great to talk about that. I don't want to spoil any of that just yet, but now that we have the intros done, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be filling in as much of the episode with music from Bonk's Revenge because it is quite good, so stick around. We'll be right back to talk about the history of Bonk's Revenge. We're back to talk about the history of Bonk's Revenge, and when we're digging up information for this episode, not a lot when it comes to Bonk's Revenge. Like, for the previous episode, we talked about Super Mario Brothers 3, and there's just a treasure trove of information, and of course, you had the wizard and all that stuff going along with it, but Brandon was digging up stuff, and also Steve was digging up some stuff, so we're going to do our best to cover this. And for the release date specifically, looks like we were able to lock down a release date of July 18th, 1990 in Japan. That's from pcengine.co.uk. And Brandon, I believe you contributed that to the outline for the show.
Yeah, that guy, he does a lot of research, so I trust his assessment there.
Perfect. And also in North America, you know, 1991 sometime, probably earlier in 1991, but, you know, we can't be sure. This is, again, going by my most trusted resource on the internet, wikipedia.com. And Steve, you're able to pick up that it was on EGM number 19. It was actually on the cover of the magazine.
Yeah, it was on the cover, and then they had like a 15-page Turbo Champ sort of supplement in there, and it was a preview, so they didn't even know it was called Bonk's Revenge. They just sort of like cut out the Bonk's part and said it was a sequel. And then the release date stated there was July 91, and like, it's going to be great. You can breathe fire, all this other cool stuff. And then I saw the actual review was in EGM 25, which is the August 91 issue, and it got 30 out of 40.
Not bad, you know, not bad. Not bad for an EGM review. Some other info, just the developer was, again, Red, published by Hudson Soft. And then I just threw this into the outline because I was going through the instruction book, and Atlas was also contributed in terms of copyright on the game itself. I don't know if that was, you know, some sort of translation that work that they did for the game or not. Obviously, the game does not need a lot of text to be translated, but for some reason, Atlas was involved. I don't know if either of you guys know what that was all about, but I thought it was worth mentioning at least.
Well, were I to venture a guess, Atlas back in those days was not particularly known for much of anything. They weren't, you know, the company that we now know for Persona and Shin Megami Tensei and all of that stuff. They were a much smaller company that was transitioning out of, at the time, out of being a kind of like a programming house, somewhat like Tose is currently, like a ghost developer, where they would do programming tasks or art tasks behind the scenes. And my guess is that's what they did here, because Red was generally less a developer and more of a kind of a coordinator, organizer, producer type of situation. They would get, you know, they would get the cool artist for Far East of Eden, what is it called? Kabukiden? I forget. Anyway, they would get the artists together with the programming team and kind of guide the whole thing, but they weren't necessarily a developer all the time. So it's pretty ambiguous who did what on this thing, and it will be very hard to find out because we were still in the era of not really using real names as much and not crediting everybody. So, but maybe there, someday I'm sure we'll be able to find this, put those GD research guys on it, and maybe we'll get to the bottom of that.
Yeah, the credits for this game are actually a lot shorter than Bonk's Adventure. Doesn't show any of the enemies or anything. It's just like, here's a couple names, and then that's it.
It's super abrupt, very much like, again, last week we were talking about Super Mario Brothers 3, and coming, that was the first time I ever beat Super Mario Brothers 3, and then being used to getting to the end of Super Mario World and seeing the long credits that they had for Super Mario World, going through all the enemies and the worlds and stuff like that, and just to have it kind of like say, all right, you know, this is who designed Bonk. Couple programmers, that's it. But also, I want to quickly mention, as we are talking about some more TurboGrafx stuff, I mentioned it, I believe, on the first episode, and these are the only two TurboGrafx games we've done on the show up to this point with 33 episodes, but Retronauts, episode 75, Brandon, you're actually on that episode too, and just some fantastic recommendations for people out there. If you're just starting to get into like PC Engine, TurboGrafx stuff, go check that out. It is well worth listening to because there's lots of great information on there. I used it as my resource when I picked up my PC Engine Duo R earlier this year. But going forward, just a couple other quick notes. This was actually included in the Gates of Thunder 4-in-1 CD that was part of the kind of bundle that they did when the TurboGrafx 16 and the Duo was out in 1992. So I thought that was just an interesting fun fact. It was one of the few facts that were on Wikipedia. And unlike Bonk's Adventure, this is not available on PSN. I was kind of looking for it just in case this might be a little bit of an easier way for people to play this game. But for some reason, they decided to not release it on there. I don't know if that was just a case of when Hudson got sold, and then they decided to not release it after they were sold. So
I do believe it's on WiiWare.
Perfect. Yeah, just jump on the Wii and get the, everyone has a Wii. There's like 100 Wiis out there.
A million Wiis. I just bought one recently at a thrift store for $6.
See?
$6 is your magical price point. Sounds
that's right.
Were there any games on it?
There was, what's that balance board Wii Fit game? That was inside of it.
Oh, wow. They left it in there?
Yeah, so it came with a free disc, but there were nobody had downloaded anything onto it. But yeah, it was destroyed. It looked like it'd been run over by a car, and then a child had just, I don't know, partially digested it or something. And it was missing the kind of port flap that goes over the GameCube ports. And but it worked totally fine. So good job, Nintendo. You did it.
Yeah, Nintendo home hardware, always rock solid. Their portable stuff as well. So thank you for continuing to do that. I just got a Famicom Twin that's super old and still works, even though it kind of smells like cigarettes. We're going to take another quick break. We're going to be playing some more music from Bonk's Revenge, and then we're going to be going back to 1991, and we're going to hear some impressions of Bonk's Revenge when it was first released. So stick around. Okay, we made it back to 1991, and I'm going to sit out this segment because, as I mentioned in the Bonks Adventure episode, the only real experience I had with the TurboGrafx-16 at the time was renting it from our local, you know, video rental store. I rented it for a weekend with like Bonk's Adventure and China Warrior, and I think the other game was one of the baseball games that was on there. So I'm going to sit this one out. But first off, I'm going to send it to you, Steve. You had a very interesting story when it came to the TurboGrafx, first off, from the first episode that we did. But as you played Bonk's Adventure, were you just hyped up for Bonk's Revenge? Was that on your must-have list?
Well, so it's interesting. Around this time, the Super Nintendo hype train really started going, like EGM and everywhere else. And so in a way, I sort of turned my attention away from the TurboGrafx around this time, especially if you look at even that Bonk preview issue. There's a whole nother segment about the Super Famicom coming. And I was getting really excited about Super Nintendo. So there were things sort of competing for the funds that I had, right? And I think the thing that really, I would have bought Bonk's Revenge regardless. So I was really excited about it. But the thing that really pushed it over the edge was that there were stores that were renting Super Nintendo games as soon as it came out, but there was never a store that rented TurboGrafx games. So I always had to buy my TurboGrafx games, and for this one, I saved, I think it was like $60, but then this actually reminded me of how I bought it, which is a really random story. So there was a catalog merchant called Jewel Mart. They're kind of like service merchandise. And they were going out of business around sort of the end of summer 91. And, you know, they had 10% off, 20% off. And then they started getting to like the 40 and 50% off. And the only games they had were Monster Lair and like Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective for their TurboGrafx. So what I would do was I would buy those and then bring them to Toys R Us.
Jesus.
And get Jeffrey Money credit for the full price. And then I was basically doing arbitrage with TurboGrafx CD games, and then using that Jeffrey Money to buy whatever new games that I wanted. So that's actually how I funded buying Bonk's Revenge along with a Super Nintendo around the same time. That's how I picked it up. I was trying to think back. I remember getting it and playing through it pretty quickly, thinking, hey, it's got better graphics, it's got better sound, I don't like the control as much. And it was more of like a speed run, I think, at the time, because there was all these other games. And I think I was just, I bought Bonk, let me try to get through Bonk. And I played it a lot like Bonk's Adventure, where you're just trying to get through it as quickly as possible. And then it wasn't till later, when I kind of picked it up again, that I realized, hey, this game's actually got a lot of secrets. There's a lot of things that I'm missing. Mm-hmm. I didn't care about the elevator going up like however many smileys at first.
Yeah.
But then I started realizing, hey, this game would probably be a lot easier. And then what am I missing now that it's not going all the way up? And is there a different ending? And this is still like playground rumors. It's like, oh, if you finish it on expert without dying, then Princess Zah takes her clothes off or something. Something dumb like that. And so you have to just sort of play through it. And I got a lot better at it. And I think my fondness for the game grew over time. It wasn't like when I first got it, I was like, hey, this is great. That EGM 30 out of 40 review is about right. I was like, there's parts of this I don't like. I can't spin my way across the level or anything. But, it was later on when I realized that there's a lot of stuff that I could discover that I thought my impression of the game got a lot better.
Do you think that 30 out of 40 was just based off of the horrible, schedule for reviewers at the time of just having, a couple days to play through a game, then you got to get that review out before the issue has to be done?
Well, I think you could have gotten through this game. I mean, I got through it the first time I played it when I was a kid. And I think there was a lot of games. And I think that was the thing. It's like it came out at a time when the Super Nintendo was coming out. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of really impressive. I think Streets of Rage came out the same month as Bonk's Revenge. And so there's all this great stuff. And that really kind of diminishes what Bonk's Revenge was compared to when it was released, for instance, in 1990 in Japan.
Yeah, I was gonna give you some junk for the Toys R Us thing, but when I was working at GameStop in college, we had some kind of like rewards program through Microsoft where it was like a retailer rewards, and I got like Blue Dragon and a couple other games, and went to Walmart and returned them for full credit, and then would just go buy something else. I did not end up playing Blue Dragon at any point, but Brandon, how about yourself? When did you get, the first access to Bonk's Revenge? Were you really anticipating the game? Did you already have a TurboGrafx at the time?
I have a different path than a lot of people, perhaps, because I couldn't afford any game consoles when they were new, period, ever. When I say ever, I mean up until I became an adult and had a real full-time job. I could not afford game consoles, but I did have a job when I was 12, and I kind of saved up and got my first Turbo. I guess I had the regular just chip console from a yard sale, but I got the Duo in 1994, I think. When did it come out? 92? I guess it was 93 then. Mm-hmm. Yeah, got it in 93. Sorry about that. But the first time I actually played Bonk was when I was at someone's house, and I was left there by myself for some reason, and this must have been in 1991, and it was one of the four games they had, because pretty much anybody, if you went to their house and they had a TurboGrafx, that was rare, first of all. And second of all, they didn't have very many games usually. And it was one of them. But I actually cannot recall my impressions whatsoever in that first viewing. When I really played it was when I got the Duo and it came with that Gate of Thunder 4-in-1 pack-in, actually. I didn't really play it before that. And, I was kind of more enticed by all the games that had the CD sound, but Bonk's Revenge really kind of grabbed me, and it grabbed me much more than Bonk's Adventure, because for me, they came to my attention at the same exact time. Like, I didn't read magazines. I had no concept that there were a whole bunch of people interested in video games. I just got video games as they came to me cheaply, and I played them, and I really liked this game, and it struck me as very different from the other kinds of, I guess, mascot games that I had seen. Like, I had played Mario games before, and I kind of liked them. I thought they were all right, but they didn't really grab me in the same way as this game did. But I could see why it might not have been as popular, because Bonk was certainly not as cool as Sonic or as ubiquitous as Mario. He's like a caveman. You all probably know this, but his name in Japan, him being called PC Genjin, it's a little bit of a joke on the name of the console, the PC Engine. So he was like directly tied into it, and Genjin means caveman. So he was the PC caveman. But it was all like a double pun kind of situation. So he was very tied into the console, and it was made by Hudson, who was partially responsible for the creation of the hardware in the first place. So Bonk was like way more in this system's DNA than any of the other mascots were to theirs. But I guess I really enjoyed it at the time, but I didn't think about it very critically until I think I got the PS2 and GameCube ports of Bonk's Adventure, which were really, actually, really excellent. Like, those, if you haven't played that, definitely go and revisit that, because they took it to a different level. Like, when you bonk enemies with your head, you can keep bouncing on top of them, and you can actually use your spin to get high up into the air, higher than you could normally, and they put little secrets up there for you and stuff. You can keep hitting these enemies infinitely. It kind of changes it up and makes it quite interesting. But when I played that, it made me go back and think about that game a bit more and realize that it did have a fair bit of influence on me, I guess, as a game designer, and also just in terms of the games that I like, which tend to be, and this sounds silly and pretentious, but I do find myself drawn to games that are very interesting but flawed. Mm-hmm. Because when something's too good, when it's too smooth, it's less interesting to me because it doesn't have, you don't have those peaks and valleys. It doesn't have those rough spots to compare against. So for me, Bonk's Revenge was definitely one of those games.
Steve, were you like in Bonk's Adventure, were you automatically switched to turning on the turbo?
Yeah, so we'll get into this in the next section, but I actually played it with a two-button pad this time. I think when I played Bonk's Adventure, I was using the six buttons, so it was harder to do the turbo. I looked in the manual for Bonk's Revenge. It actually suggests that you turn on turbo for button two, so I'm validated. That the whole cheating to use the turbo, I just totally disagree with. But yeah, I, in playing it, I definitely played it using the same technique, but because of the changes in things like the spin speed, and as Brandon mentioned, you can't bonk enemies more than once. Mm-hmm. It changed a lot of, I guess, what I thought I knew about bonk, and maybe that's why I didn't like it as much. It's, you know, I've learned these things. This is how I play the game, and now you're not letting me play it that way. So that was probably some of the initial frustration for me. Brandon, I'm interested in hearing from you, like, what you thought were those peaks and what were those valleys for Bonk's Revenge once you sort of revisited it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it is kind of a bit loose sometimes when you're playing it, but I think the peaks and valleys are in terms of some of the levels, some of the levels are more tight than others. Like the orange hills and orange waterfall kind of redux levels are pretty limp and lame. And there's the beach, which is almost basically a throwaway, like no level design. And the bosses, they are relatively well thought out, but they're not super well implemented. So they have, they've got weird hitboxes. They do things that you don't quite expect. And so those would be the valleys, but the peaks are basically, you know, it was one of those early games that made me feel like it had a living world, mm-hmm. really. The hatchet guys who are the main enemy, they're asleep a lot of the time. They're just hanging out, sliding down a hill or whatever. Starting with the laundry pools level where you're stealing everyone's laundry, mm-hmm. and then you go to their hometown and start harassing them where they live. And they're, you know, like matronly washerwomen, and there are lights on in the houses, and it just feels like a world. Similarly, the warship hold and sailor saloon where you've got cooks and stuff, and it's all tied into the fact that there's all this food all around. It just feels like a place where if you weren't there bonking stuff, it would just exist on its own. It would just keep going. And that gives me a really good feeling about the game world. It's like a good hangout place. And another sort of peaks and valleys-ish thing is the feeling of different frictions that the game is constantly presenting you with. Like the difference between landing on your feet and landing on your head, which is different when you're on regular solid ground versus when you're on ice. Like if you land your head on ice, you just slide until you jump. Or the friction of going through the air by jumping, or through spinning with turbo, which are all three different things. And so that is simultaneously loose, some might say a bit too loose, but also very interesting because it gives you a varied feeling within one play session, and I quite like that.
Well, I never thought of you're invading where they live, and then you think about it, yeah, like socks and things are flying through the air, and they're just asleep, and you're just terrorizing them.
Yep, that's pretty much the way I feel about it.
Yes, Bonk's a horrible person.
He's
And then for you, Brandon, when you're, again, you mentioned you kind of waited for stuff to get, you know, affordable or cheaper. But at this point, you know, going into Bonk's Adventure or Bonk's Revenge, you said you like this more than like the Super Mario Brothers games. But what have you played up until that point? Did you get to take a look at Super Mario World, or was your, you know, experience pretty much with 1, 2, and 3?
Well, it's a bit difficult for me to say the order of things, but like whether I saw that first or second, because again, since I wasn't buying these things when they came out, it's all kind of a mush for me. But I do remember seeing Super Mario World in my friend's basement and watching him play and then trying to play it a bit and not liking how it felt at all. I felt like he was too slippery and there was too much inertia, and it didn't work for me because I was used to this like stickiness that I think I got from playing Bonk, because he moves, when he's on the ground, he moves very predictably. And when he lands very predictably, unless you're on a different kind of surface. And you can predict it in Super Mario World as well. It's just a different kind of thing, and it didn't really work for me. I didn't like the overworld map. I found that kind of, it was my first time seeing an overworld map, and I found that disorienting actually when I was a kid. I liked Super Mario Brothers 3 significantly more than Super Mario World. I would say that in the era, in the 90s, I played Super Mario World probably a total of an hour.
Wow,
that's always a fun debate to have, the three versus worlds. But we'll table that for now. Let's take another break, and then we'll go back to our, you know, impressions of revisiting the game and kind of how it holds up. And then I can jump into the conversation a little bit. But this is super interesting to hear your guys' thoughts, because it almost feels like you were playing the game with me. it is very weird to, you know, have a lot of the same things written down here. But like I said, we're going to take a quick break. Hear some more music from Bonk's Revenge. Stick around. Okay, we made it all the way back to 2014, and we have our RGB modified PC engines potentially, and we are firing up Bonk's Revenge, myself for the first time, but for you guys, you are revisiting it. So Steve, I'll toss it off to you first. You know, what was it like for you to boot this game back up and to play it again? I think I saw from Twitter that you were playing it you know, through that great Dojin Dance PC engine.
Yeah, so I had the Dojin Dance Duo RX through the FrameMeister to my monitor, and like I said, I switched to the 2-button pad instead of the 6-button pad this time. So got through it, starting it up. There was a lot of memories that came back. I had forgotten how much I didn't like the spin again. You know, because the last game I had played kind of extensively was Bonk's Adventure for the last podcast. So I kind of fired it up like, oh, yeah, I forgot that this was so slow. But I did know to start looking for secrets, but I didn't remember how important that was. And I think I died around the 5th level, somewhere in there. And then I continued and then realized like everything was wiped out, right? I lost my hearts and all the guy and everything else. And so I actually stopped and reset and then went back to the beginning and then did the let me find every single flower and do all the power-ups and smileys. And then I had forgotten about the warp as well. So when I got the 50 smileys and I did the Princess Zah warp, I was actually really surprised. Like, wait, what? Oh, I forgot. Like, if you get 50, you know, you get to go.
How did you know this? Did you just, you knew this from experience in the past?
No. So I remembered it from the past, but I had forgotten about it completely. Mm-hmm. I was just going after the smileys and, you know, the game kind of hints to where you need to go. There's this something over in this corner for no reason. Or if it's too open, you're realizing that there's probably something over here. Or I just need to keep going. And so it took a lot longer doing the exploration of the game. And then some of it started coming back to me. I started getting better at the controls, and that way I was able to finish it without continuing, which was always the key for me. It was having a lot of hearts because, you know, as Brandon mentioned earlier, some of the hitboxes on the bosses are weird. They do some really funky things, and it was just like a couple of cheap hits, and then I would die. So I was like, all right, I got to make sure I load up, especially when I get to the end where I have to face everybody again. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. I think I had fun going back and seeing how much I remembered. And then after I had finished it, I loaded up a FAQ and was seeing like what things that I missed. I tried to find speed runs and seeing what were those exploits that I never knew about as a kid. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was similar where you get hit on purpose so you can get thrown into the air and stuff like that. It wasn't as fast as I thought it'd be. But you know, I think it's like 30 minutes or something is the speed run. And then the other thing I forgot was, you know, making sure that you bonk the flowers so that they'll, you know, throw out meat and not just push you in the air.
Mm-hmm. This is for the snobby Framemeister owners out there, but that this game, you know, makes that thing worth, you know, the price of admission because whether you're going through RGB or even through composite, like I hooked up my Duo to, you know, via composite and the game just looked so bland. But when you go through that RGB, like I was going to my 55 inch you know, LCD through the Framemeister with the, you know, SCART cable, that game looks friggin' super nice. It is just, it really pops, and it just, I can only imagine what it must have been like to have, like, in 1991, seeing that game next to Super Mario Brothers 3 and just have it just blows Super Mario Brothers 3, and just in terms of visuals and just having, you know, gigantic characters on the screen. So it is just for those people out there, it's again, you know, another reason to maybe, you know, invest in one of those.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But I'm going to say, for me, this was like a little bit of an emotional roller coaster, playing this game. I had such highs and lows with this, with going back, or I guess not even going back and playing it, but for myself playing it, like the first thing I did was, you know, sit down, I opened up a Twitch stream and started streaming the game just because, you know, sometimes it's a little bit more, I get a little bit more encouraged to play the game when I have some audience there. But I did the same thing you did, Steve. I went into the instruction booklet to say, all right, maybe I played the first one wrong. You know, I really like Bonk's Adventure. I really enjoyed that game. But maybe I played it wrong. And I have like the instructions in front of me right now. It says, you know, in terms of playing tips and hints, don't jump on all flowers immediately. Instead, bonk them first to see if they will change color. Generally, put turbo switches on for button 2 and off for button 1. Practice your triangle jumps. It's necessary to finish the game. Timing is everything. And then it gives you a couple other pointers. And then, of course, you know, if you really need some help, call the TurboGrafx hotline at 1-900-FUN-TG16. It's free for the first 30 seconds. And then
like a buck a minute or something like that.
It's a buck a minute up to 5 minutes. So, you know, not too bad of a deal. You know, it might actually have been a little bit more competitive than what Nintendo had going on at the time. But, for me, like I said, it was kind of an emotional roller coaster, and even like getting like booting up the game and then seeing 3 difficulty options and being a little confused because like expert is the whole game. Intermediate is just 4 levels. And then practice is just the first level. So it's not.
I don't think I've ever picked the other two.
Well, why would you?
Right.
You're not playing the whole game, and it makes no sense to me why they would do that, because it's really not offering you a level of difficulty. It's just allowing you to have, you know, a smaller game with more hearts to start. But, you know, that was just maybe an initial observation. But the thing I kind of penned on, and this is, I might have said this on Bonk's Adventure 2, but for me, referencing Super Mario Bros. 3 coming off of that episode, this was like the Dark Souls of platformers for me, because I felt like if I made one wrong move, if I, you know, bonked too early after making a jump and I was trying to go for like a, you know, a headbutt dive, I was stuck for a second. I'd start getting hit by enemies. I'd start, you know, getting pissed off because I thought, you know, I had the timing there right. And, you know, before throwing it off to Brandon, like for me, I thought the timing on the jumps were like off. Like I felt like I had, you know, gum under my shoes when I was trying to jump, because it would have that half a second or, you know, 0.2 of a second delay before Bonk would actually jump after hitting the button, where I just felt like the timing was off, you know, the whole time. And that's why I said I hooked it up to my PVM, my CRT, to see if it was just like the Framemeister. But no, it was just kind of like the mechanics and the physics of the game.
Are you sure it wasn't your controller? Because I actually went, I had the same experience when I first turned it on with, I think I was even using one of the first PC Engine controllers, and I thought it felt really mushy.
Yeah.
So I switched to, I think, like the Shuttle Graphics controller or something like that, where it was more of a clicky button. And then I maybe this is just perception. Oh, I switched the controller, it's going to feel better. But my jumping did feel a lot better after I switched controllers.
It's possible. Like I have two PC Engine controllers, and then I have that six button. And one of the PC Engine controllers that I got with the Duo, like the button doesn't work half the time. And then the other controller that is like all yellowed and stuff seems to work better, but maybe I should have tried that six button as well. I don't know. Maybe the PC Engine controllers just have a tendency to break down easily.
Yes, they do.
Yes.
Great.
They do break. And that is my, my assumption about you, because I have, you know, I've got controllers that work better than others. Cause I got about, I don't know, 15 or so controllers for that console across TurboGrafx and PC Engine. I just like to, anytime I see one that looks different, I pick it up.
Yeah.
I've got the Hudson Honeybee controller that it daisy chains together, which
nice.
Is like, but yeah, some, you know, if that was happening to you, it shouldn't have been. Like there's it shouldn't lag at all when you hit the jump button. It should be fine. So
damn,
then it's probably just the switch engaging lower down is the problem.
Yeah, try the six button controller, or we can probably send you one that we used.
All right, guys, we're gonna pause for an hour, and I'm gonna go play the game one more time.
Okay.
Well, I was still able to get through the whole game even with that issue, so it wasn't. I got used to it at some point. But Brandon, for you, before I go any further, you know, how does the game hold up for you? Like, what kind of things were coming back to you as you were playing it?
So first of all, I'm just gonna talk about the controller thing a little bit and say that, you know, if one considers it a Dark Souls of platformers, then one should certainly not have the turbo turned on button too.
Oh, I didn't. I felt like I never turned it on, because I still am in that, like, I don't know. It feels like it's cheating for me. I was always taught growing up as a kid, those turbo controllers, that's cheating.
Yeah, well, so I turn them on when I have to do certain mini games, like the falling mini game when you're falling from the tower, because that's the only way that you can actually spin with enough speed or slowness, because you fall at different rates depending on whether you're turbo or actually hitting the button. Theoretically, you can hit the button that fast, but anyway, I only turn it on for those sequences. Otherwise, I try to be very precise about it. And so I did not actually replay it right before this podcast, but I've played it, you know, several times a year for the last 10 years, so I don't feel I have to worry about that too much. So it's not like I don't actually have the ability to revisit it after a long time, because it hasn't been a long time since I've played it. So what I did instead was I watched a Let's Play of it. And that was really interesting, because I had never watched someone else play through the game carefully. Mm-hmm. And I kept watching this person do what my brain told me is the wrong thing. They were technically proficient and good at the game, but they'd go down a path that I'd never, because I, you know, I've got these paths in my mind that I take through the levels, and I'm like, oh, what are you doing? You're doing that. You're missing all the stuff. But
so is this person trying to get through it and not really go for all the points and everything else? Or?
No, they actually went for a lot of points, and they in fact got the warp, which I never get because I like all the levels that it's possible to skip. So I never get up to 50 because like if you get between 30 and 49, you still get your empty blue heart. And so it's still good enough.
So if you're at 49 and you see another smiley, you'll not get it.
Yeah, that's right. Cause okay. I don't want to skip because I enjoy playing through it. I guess if I were to do a speed run attempt, I would do that, but otherwise no. But then, you know, just in terms of kind of general impressions, thinking about it more as a game designer type of a human being nowadays, I like how, as Steve was saying, it can lead you to secrets a lot of the time. Like in the snowy mountain area, there are houses, and there's one, little igloos, and one of the igloos has a big question mark of explodable little snowflakes above it, and if you smash the ground below that, then it goes into another area, and that kind of stuff is cool. I think you'll have an arrow made out of you know, cherries or something. I can't remember what it's made out of. And if you bonk the ground right below that, then you get a special flower. One thing I really like is how, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but there are points that you can kind of unveil under almost every sign. Like if you bonk the ground in front of the level start sign, there's usually like, I don't know, like French fries or a soda or something there that you can collect.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And once you know that, in the volcano castle level, if you smack underneath the sign there, you get to a hidden area that's below that's got a like a flying flower and stuff. And that's how you can get the smiley faces that are in the kind of skull clouds that come out of the volcanoes that are nearby. So I like that they have a consistency to their secrets, and then they try to subvert it, and then they try to lead you around. I really like that. I also like that there are alternate paths through the levels generally, and there are also alternate ways to get to those alternate paths. So for example, in level 2-1, you can smack the floret and turn it yellow instead of jumping on it. Mm-hmm. And that'll get you up to this higher path. But alternately, you can headbutt the boulder that rolls by, and you can bounce off of that backward and grab it with your teeth, and then you can get up to that alternate path. So there are two paths and then two ways to get to that path. And I really like that, the kind of freedom that they have for you to make the game at least your own a little bit. But I also like when they don't do that, when there's a path that is completely one-time use, pretty much. It's in the snowy mountains. There are a whole bunch of smileys at the top of the level to the left. I think it's in the second mountains one. And the only way you can get it to them is by hitting these tiny little non-regenerative enemies. Once you bonk them, they're gone.
Oh, and yeah, like the little like sunflower looking things or whatever.
Yeah, those little guys. So you've got to hit those in the right sequence, or else you can't actually get there because they never come back. And there's a one up there as well. And if you miss any of that stuff, then you know, you just don't get to go there. And I like that. I also like how they, again, with that living world stuff, your basic enemies are kind of changed in each level. You know, they've got little sailor hats in the warship level. In the snowy levels, they've got scarves, and now they're throwing snowballs because it's cold. It's, I think, reusing the basic look of the enemy, but then repurposing it for a new environment is really nice because it again feels like you're progressing through an actual world. It's not different enemies every time. It's you're fighting the same guys, but now they're the types of guys that live in the cold, or they're the types of guys that are on a ship. And it's much more involving that way, I think. So those are kind of my thoughts about it. I never really liked the end of the game with the boss rush. Mm-hmm. It's kind of boring to me, and it feels like the end of the game, they were just kind of done. They're like, we got to tack on some more stuff here, and then we're gonna finish it. The end of the game, there's very little of the kind of joy that I feel earlier on. It's all just hardcore figuring out your hitboxes situation stuff, which is not nearly as engaging to me.
Can you guys think of a game where you enjoyed that, like, all right, I finished, you know, I beat these six bosses leading up to the final stage. It's like the Mega Man thing that's like in every Mega Man game where you have to face all the robots again as you go through Wily's levels. Is there a game where you can think, man, I really enjoyed that they put that in there instead of just like adding length to it?
There's only one that I can think of, which is... and it's not all exactly in a sequence, but they all come back. It's Rocket Slime Adventure for the DS.
Really?
Yeah.
It's that's one of my favorite DS games. I really love that game, even though it's for kids and it's pretty easy. But I really like it. But it's fun to come back and defeat these guys that you defeated them before a long time ago. And now they're back and they're tougher, and they're it feels pretty good to succeed against them again, because, you know, they make a big to do about being better, and then, you know, you can still do it. So I enjoyed it in that game.
Yeah, I mean, the end of Bonk's Revenge, I think they're like, well, we did it in Bonk's Adventure where you had to turn them back into stone or whatever, mm-hmm. or they unfrozen. Let's just do it again. But, you know, the end, just the whole end sequence in general is really anticlimactic, and the end just feels like tacked on because King Drool III just says, I'll be back. And he sort of floats off. You know, the worlds come together. She's like, hey, it's great. The moon's back together. Gives you a kiss, and then it shows the end. And, you know, I liked Bonk's Adventure where it had, you know, everybody's waving at the end. And it was just a lot more charming in terms of the end. This one just felt like, you know, Brandon was saying, they just got really tired and like, well, okay, I guess we'll figure out what to do here.
Yeah, Mike, it's one of those situations where it feels like it was rushed out of there. But, you know, I don't know that they built the whole thing in sequence necessarily. So maybe maybe it wasn't. But it definitely gives that impression, which is too bad because the rest of the game is really, I really like it, and I really like what it does with environment, and it just yanks that all away from you at the end. And I think even if they did have like a cool, charming sequence afterward, I think that would redeem it for me, but it's not there. Too bad.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned like it felt like it was rushed, and we're talking, or, you know, it was potentially, you know, maybe they were under a time crunch. And you know, just initially when I started playing it, like the first thing that started bumming me out, because I talk about it almost every episode of this podcast, is that, you know, I really, the music of a game really helps, you know, bring enjoyment for me. I don't know why it is, but I love listening to video game music, like even more than I listen to current day music. But, you know, having some tracks reused kind of bummed me out, but, you know, you can always make that, you know, relationship, you know, with other games when it, there's a sequel so close, you know, some of the assets are going to be reused again. Some of the music is going to be reused. But, you know, I just wanted to hear some more stuff in terms of the music and things like that. But also, I don't know if you guys saw, you know, there's like an amazing list of cheats for this game that was really groundbreaking, like, you know, being able to remove the pause text when you pause the game. So it doesn't say pause. That was a joke.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, not a whole lot of cheats you can do.
No, and same thing, like I was saying before, I felt like you guys were playing the game with me, because that was the thing that was bugging the crap out of me the most, was the hit detection on some of the bosses and some of the enemies where, you know, I felt like Bonk didn't have as much reach. But the whole time, like... It was like a roller coaster, because you would have these times where you're just hitting like consecutive bonks on your like bouncing off of enemies over and over again. And they were like setting up these enemies like dominoes for you to kind of knock down. And those periods felt awesome. Like it's just like a, you know, it's really simple, but it's a great feeling to have when you are playing a game. But some of those boss battles, like, first off, there's like one level where if you haven't played the game before, they drop you into the pit for the boss battle and they just drop you on spikes.
Yeah, you get hit right away. It's like the second boss, yeah. I think.
Like, what the hell? Like, it's not even like, you're not even playing fair. And I think it was a rhinoceros that you were fighting for that. Actually, it wasn't the rhinoceros. It was a gigantic rhinoceros that was also throwing out beams, or some kind of dinosaur that would throw out beams that would freeze you. And I felt like I could just never get the hitboxes right on that. And then also on the boss with the snow level, like I felt like I was getting the timing down perfect to like headbutt on the way down after a jump. But I was hitting the boss, but I was also taking damage every single time. Yeah. So I was like, I was kind of like going nuts. I'm like, what rules am I not following to get this stuff right? But throughout the whole time, like, I was having a blast. Like, I think this is a great example of why I thought, you know, the PC Engine or the TurboGrafx like had some, you know, good merit at the time when it came out, because this game just is really beautiful looking, and I just love all the colors in the game, and it is like that really great, almost like, I don't know how to best describe it, but it's just, I don't know, maybe today with all these guns and violence and stuff, I just love going back to these games where it's just like using every color that's possible on the system, and, you know, just having things look beautiful and super crisp, you know, going through the SCART cable on the system. But the only thing, like I said, that kind of bummed me out was the hitboxes, you know, having some tracks reused, and also the bonus rounds, which now, you know, if it was a controller malfunction, if I wasn't able to like make those jumps off of, you know, the bouncy flowers to go through those bonus stages, you know, maybe that would have made things a lot easier. But I thought, you know, for the most part, I thought it was really a lot of fun. I'm really happy to have played it for the show.
Yeah, I actually like those bonus stages because, you know, I play with a controller that responds properly.
I'm bummed now. How do I go to, like, a shop, like a retro game shop in Japan, and find a controller that works?
Just get a bunch, and then some of them will work. Also, you can clean them.
I did. I opened them up. I cleaned the contacts on the controller. I, you know, wiped them down, and like, this is the same procedure I use for like every controller I get, because you always get like Genesis controllers do this a lot too, where they'll just stop responding on the D-pads. But maybe I just need to spend like $60 and buy a brand new one or something. Just like, well,
I would say you should just try to get the controllers that came with the Duo R and the Duo RX. Well, the Duo RX had the six buttons, which is basically the PCFX controller.
Yep.
But if you get get newer ones, the newer the better, and you got a higher likelihood of functionality. I've been playing a lot of these with a lot of these controllers, and my most reliable ones are one Duo R controller and one Super Graphics controller.
Okay. Good tips. Okay.
Yeah. They just work. But I like those bonus missions, because they're all higher level kind of versions of interactions you have to do in the game all the time.
Yeah.
So they train you up to do better in an environment where you don't actually take damage or get hurt. Like, you can lose out on bonuses, but it's a kind of like a safer place to practice more complicated stuff, but it still has pressure on you because there's time and it's a difficult thing that you're trying to do. And I do like that. I think it's pretty clever way to go about it. Some of the stages I don't really like, I can never get through that stupid piranha one with any piranhas. That'll never happen, I don't think, in my life, but it's theoretically possible. I've seen it, but yeah, but I like that overall.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Kevin, you were mentioning what I liked about Bonk's Adventure, and then what I learned to like about Bonk's Adventure, find these areas is where you can kind of feel like you're in a zone, and the bonus levels were really those areas where, you know, it's a sequence of events. And, you know, Brandon, that's a great point, like teaching you certain things, like the one where you're not supposed to hit the volcano, the meteors or whatever.
Yeah.
It teaches you just to like move slightly to get out of the way so you can catch the fruit. And you can really use that dodge, especially in a lot of the boss battles where they have something coming from the ceiling or something like that. It just kind of teaches you those little moves. And then for me, I think I kind of lost my train of thought, but I think those are really fun experiences for me. Oh, yeah. The climbing the bamboo where you could like flip from one to the other really quickly, mm-hmm. and you could just climb up, like go vertical really fast. I didn't even care if I got hit at one point. I just wanted to see Bonk coming, like flying up the top. So
it's a,
I really
it's a
enjoyed
really
that
cool mechanic. It is. Yeah. Like, it's just a lot of fun to watch.
When I was on the Insert Credit podcast and we were talking about Bonk versus Mario 3, one of the things I really like about Bonk is how much verticality there is to the levels. Like they're big. They're pretty big maps. They have they have a lot more vertical space than a lot of other games had at the time versus horizontal space. You're not just going left to right, you're going up a lot, but it's in ways that feel more natural, like that spinning around kind of move that you do on the on those palm trees. Like that's in most other games, you just have to hit the jump button a whole lot of times. And you're jumping, and you still have to wait for gravity to pull you back down. In this one, you can just go up. They have a mechanic for you to just go up. And it feels like they really wanted you to... They wanted you to explore a lot. And that's why they put all these... They gave you this moveset that allowed you to kind of... Sometimes it felt like you were... you know, breaking the game, or you were pulling one over on them. Even though they gave you these tools, it's like, oh man, I was able to get here by doing this thing that feels like I shouldn't be able to, but I'm here. I like that stuff.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think, you know, finding all those secrets, sometimes like, you know, they put it there, but how you got there, it's like, oh, they didn't think of me getting it to this way or something. Right. So.
Yeah, you guys mentioned like a ton of secrets, which I found one. I found two of the heart containers or the extra hearts throughout the whole game. And what, you know, you guys were talking about, I just need to play more of the game and find some of these secrets because they're clearly there. And to hear, you know, some of these tips and tricks. Now I just want to find a working controller and play the game again. But and you said, you know, the secret stages. Even though, like, I was having trouble with them, they're all over the place. So they're really easy to, you know, continue to retry them because you can see those flowers all over the stages. And it's a relatively short game. So I played through it today and got through it in, like, an hour and 10 minutes. And as I got, you know, better and better with the mechanics of the game, like, I only used one continue for this playthrough. And you ended up, like, getting to the last stage or the last world, whatever you want to call it. I had like 8 bonks. Like I was fully stocked and ready to go. So it is a game that rewards you to replay it a couple times to really get an understanding of the mechanics and the physics and things like that. Yeah, like I said, I just want to get another controller. Now I'm going to be looking on eBay tonight to see if I can get something that is going to be a little bit more responsive for me.
Yeah, we'll just ship you one. Or I'll ship you one.
No, I get some Saturn games to buy too. So I got some work to do. But
all right.
So anything else from you guys, just in terms of, you know, things about, you know, Bonk's Revenge, you know, anything that you would say for the people out there that are considering the game, Steve?
Well, in the end, I found it more enjoyable than Bonk's Adventure, which I didn't feel as I picked up the controller for the first time. Brandon mentioned this early on. It's a must-have if you have the TurboGrafx or PC Engine. It's one of the better games on the system. And there's a lot that we can learn. I never thought of you're invading someone's home, the Chikun home. But it's interesting to take a look at that. But it does have replayability as well, especially if you want to see how far you can get with score or how many lives you have left, things like that. Definitely a must pick up. It's kind of too bad. I guess you're saying it's on WiiWare, but hopefully it's available. I mean,
it's a cheap, if you want to get the Hue card, it's pretty cheap.
Getting the Hue is not bad. I mean, just pick it up loose. You don't need to read the manual and get the 1-900 number or anything. So it's definitely, it'll probably be with any TurboGrafx you pick up, but something you should definitely pick up.
I don't think I ever read the manual at any time. So that may have informed how I played the game and my path of discovery. But yeah, I guess my main thought is it's a real good hangout game. If you like hanging out in a video game world, then that's a good one to do it in. And yeah, it's a game you should get. It's really good. It's hard for me to say. There's so many good games that I would call it one of the best, but I'd put it like in my top 30. Or something, because I love that console. So, but yeah, you should everyone should play it if you're interested in platformers and you're interested in kind of the mascot wars of the 90s. This is the 16-bit platform game that you may not have played, and it's like it came for some people. Frank Cifaldi was telling me this, that playing TurboGrafx games was like he was experiencing someone else's childhood. Like it was a total different vibe than what he had, you know, trading Nintendo games with friends, or, you know, saying that Sonic wasn't as cool as Mario or something, you know, or that Sonic was cooler than Mario, rather. Bonk is just like from an alternate timeline in some ways. It's too bad that it's so expensive to get TurboGrafx stuff now. One thing that really makes me sad is that it feels like now all of a sudden that people are interested in the TurboGrafx and are trying to collect it. A lot of people are collecting it just to collect it, and because it's a thing that you can get all of theoretically, because there weren't that many US releases, and so people are just getting these games and not playing them. So I would urge anyone that is, you know, into TurboGrafx or into this kind of stuff, actually play these games, and especially play this one. And if you don't want to do that, maybe you should get out of the hobby.
Yeah, just go book a flight to Japan like I did, and then come back with 25 new TurboGrafx games or PC Engine games and CDs and stuff. Just throw it on a credit card. Worry about it later. And play some Bonk's Revenge. But I will say, for me as someone that was a newcomer, and that, like, the PC Engine for these last 6 months has been very new for me, and it is just, I'm just going to echo what you're saying, Brandon. It is just a really interesting console to check stuff out for, and like to check out like Outrun on the PC Engine, or to, you know, check out some of these games that were like later ported to the Sega Genesis, but to play their, you know, disc based versions as well. Like Valis 3, I think is one of the ones that is really cool to check out. But
I love Valis, by the way. Valis is that's like, that game for me is one of those. I love these kind of 7 out of 10 sort of games, and yeah. Valis is, it's fantastic. I actually read a whole article about how I realized that the design of Valis has influenced the way that I make video games forever. So Valis is pretty cool. It's not perfect at all, and it's not great, but it is very interesting, and it's quite good, and it's got great music. So Valis, play that.
Is that on Gamma Sutra?
Yep.
Okay, I'll see if I can track that down, and we'll link to that in the show notes. But you know, just finally, remember, please be sure to ask your parents' permission before you call the TurboGrafx hotline, because it does cost money and it wants to show up on their phone bill. But this is going to be the end of the Bonk's Revenge talk. We're going to be coming back in just a second. We're going to be talking about a ton of stuff, including, you know, PVMs. We're going to be talking about, you know, some Sega Saturn stuff and also Sonic and Knuckles. Stick around. We'll be right back. Just do some general discussion, some retro game talk. And this was something that was like written in the outline. I think, Steve, you brought this up, but Brandon's Sonic and Knuckles experiment. So
yeah.
What is this?
So, well, I was in Austin, Texas for a show called Rooster Teeth Expo. And I was staying with a guy who, you know, we went around to some retro game shops, and he was talking about how when he was younger, he's probably like 6 or 7 years younger than me to begin with. So when he was younger, Sonic and Knuckles carts were actually really cheap to get, because the Genesis was kind of past its prime, and he knew that you could plug them in to other things. You could plug them into each other. And so he and his friends decided to see how many Sonic and Knuckles carts you could stack on top of each other before they would stop working. So we decided to replicate this experiment, because it turned out he still had 13 Sonic and Knuckles carts. So we took these and we just documented the whole process of what would happen the more you put in there. We also gave ourselves a rule that Sonic 3 had to be on top, so that, because then we knew it was communicating all the way up, because it would be Sonic 3 and Knuckles. Because sometimes you can lose the connection in there, and then it would just be Sonic and Knuckles, and we would know that we weren't actually getting all of them. So over, you know, at first it was pretty normal, and we were like, oh, nothing is really going to happen. But then I don't know the specifics of how it worked, but I think the games are all looking for data in certain areas. And when you chain it, it starts to change where that stuff is looking, or how much data there is for it to look through. So it starts to get glitchy, like the everything will turn green, or the title starts to glitch out. At one point, instead of Sonic, it was... the S was flickering, the first S, the O was clear, was sharp, but then the N was flickering between an S and an N. So it looked like it was saying SOS, like the game was trying to cry for help. And that was pretty amazing. So we wound up getting it all the way up 13 carts with Sonic 3 on top, and we could actually move. But at this point it was just giant glitch squares. Like, it was just huge blocks of garbage pixels. But for a moment, you could see Sonic and you could see Tails briefly after the intro. And you could move, because we could hear the movement, we could hear the jumping. But we would always get stuck in this one box, kind of like some invisible box, something that you would just get stuck in. And so at some point, we're going to go back there with some more carts. We're going to see if we can get even more, get higher up. And it was also, by the way, as you can imagine, 13 carts high was really tough to keep working, because, you know, that's a leaning tower right there. You got to lean it against something, or else the whole thing's going to topple. We had it in a Sega CDX, and, you know, we had to have one. My friend's wife was holding the carts while he was playing, and I was videographing. And It was a big operation, and it was super fun though, and I look forward to doing more of that in the future. There are more tests that we need to undergo as well. We didn't do it with Sonic 2 to see if Knuckles would go into Sonic 2. We didn't do it with we also want to see just how far we can get Sonic and Knuckles alone, because when you didn't have Sonic 3 in there, it was still glitchy, but not as
and it all the was way still- to 13.
All the way to 13, it was still relatively playable as just Sonic and Knuckles. So it's a pretty interesting thing, and we're gonna try to do some more with that next time I'm in Texas. But it was a lot more entertaining than I thought it was gonna be. I thought it was just gonna stop working, but I didn't realize it was gonna be so dramatic in its non-functionality.
Yeah, I was following it on Twitter and just waiting for you to add another card every time. So if you're on Brandon's Twitter, his account, you were doing vines, right? You're like, this is what it's like with three cards and four cards. And then you were showing the screen, but then you started showing the operation behind it with your friend's wife, like a contortionist trying to make sure this leaning tower of Sonic and Knuckles cards didn't fall or, you know, stayed connected. So it was really entertaining just to see, you know, I think as a little kid, I worked at a video game store during this time, and we never thought to do that. But just, you know, at what point, you know, does it start glitching out, and then how far can you take it? And then when you said, hey, this is when it's at 13, like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So
it was fun.
It's like a towering inferno.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I'm surprised it didn't explode. I guess they didn't really have to really test that when they're
just the QA department. Yeah. Hey, can you cook up 10 of these? What's going to happen?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it was like these were $60 a pop. You weren't going to expect anyone to do that. So
they thought wrong.
Yeah.
Yes.
They thought wrong.
See, we're still discovering things about the Sega Genesis many, many years later.
I love it.
Yeah, it's thank God they needed to split up Sonic 3 and use that lock-on technology. Otherwise, none of this would be possible.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm going to quickly mention that I love the Framemeister. You know, I really do. But there's something about a CRT. You know, about that. You know, degaussing, ding, when you fire up a CRT that you just don't get from the LCDs and the plasmas of today. So. You know, I started looking around and I was able to find a nice 14-inch Sony PVM, which for people out there who don't know, it's a professional video monitor that are used in production, or, you know, video production, television production, you know, back in the late 90s. And, you know, thank God WWE is still using them today. They still got to pull those PVMs out of the tables before they, you know, do a rock bottom on one of those Spanish announce tables. But so if you watch wrestling, you have a better idea what they look like.
And at WrestleMania, one of them fell on one of the monitors.
Oh, God. Yeah, Randy Orton got got destroyed. His back. Oh, man. Those corners are sharp. They are, you know, fully metal casings on those monitors. But the cool thing about these is that they support RGB as well as S-Video and composite. And you can find them for relatively cheap, you know, if you're willing to wait and look around for one locally on Craigslist or something like that. And I was really blown away because I was talking with Peter Brown a couple episodes back, and he's like, yeah, I keep a CRT on my desk at home. And I'm like, yeah, that'd be a great idea. I got some room on my desk. I can put a 13-inch CRT. So I grabbed my old 13-inch CRT from my parents' house and put it on there, and I, you know, played through Super Mario Brothers 3 for the last episode. But I was like, this isn't good enough because I heard about PVM. So I looked on Craigslist, found a PVM for $50 and went and picked it up. And the picture quality is just unbelievable of what you can get out of those things. And just through S-Video, being able to hook up consoles through that. The one thing that you will need if you want to hook up composite consoles is a BNC or BNC connectors for it, which are relatively easy to find. I was able to pick one up at Radio Shack. Like, that's how easy it is to pick these up, although they're a lot cheaper on Amazon or any other website that is not Radio Shack. And I just want to say, if you are listening to this show, you might want to research this because you probably care about retro games a lot more than the average person. And now I just have like a little separate, like that IKEA cube, that four cube little storage thing. I got one of those set up with my PVM on there and a second PVM coming that I was able to snag on Craigslist real cheap. And now I got my twin Famicom because the controller's cords are 3 feet long. They're like a foot long. Let's be real. And it is just, it's going to be fun. I got some SCART to BNC cables coming. So I'll be able to hook up my SCART or RGB enabled consoles up to it. And just like S-Video from a Genesis, with my S-Video modded Genesis, like looking at Streets of Rage on that thing is just unbelievable. So I can't wait to get all that stuff set up. But I forget who was mentioning, we were emailing before, but I don't know if it was Steve or Brandon, if you guys have PVMs sitting around too.
Yeah, I got one.
I've got one too.
If you go to Los Angeles frequently enough, you can get one for free because there's still production companies still phasing those out, mm-hmm. and you can just go pick one up. So I've got a 21-inch. It works pretty well. It's super stupidly heavy.
Yeah.
And I really like it, but it's not my main CRT right now because I'm having some SCART problems with it, especially with my Genesis. And so I actually only have the composite and the S-Video working. So I've just been using this giant old Toshiba that I've got. But I'm going to be getting that working well, especially since Frank Cifaldi is my neighbor and he's solved a lot of the problems already. So I can pretty much just ask to kind of get all the troubleshooting done.
Yeah, to Brandon's point, there's a lot of production houses. I did a quick search here in Vancouver and also in the Bay Area that are just swapping them out. And Kevin, I think even talked about this on a video where the wrong aspect ratio, everybody's moving to 16:9 and everything else. And so, 40, 50 bucks, 100 on the outside. And it's a great time to pick those up because, there's still a lot of people swapping them out. The picture quality is awesome, but to Brandon's point, it's also really heavy. So I think Frank's got his on a cart, right? So he can roll it into the bedroom or the living room.
So
it's important to do that because you don't want to be lifting these things too often.
Mm-hmm.
I also did the, I have a Neo Geo Omega, and hooking that up today, even just through S-Video, looks outstanding. So if you're one of those people out there that doesn't want to go the $350 route and getting SCART cables and stuff for the Framemeister, but you still want to have like your own retro corner, finding one of those PVMs, whether it be like the 20-inch or the 14 and 13-inch models, seem to be the most popular out there. I'm looking for 20-inch, but those are a little bit harder to find these days. But I'm loving it, and I think just look on Craigslist. Don't spend a lot. Don't spend more than like 50 bucks for one, but see if you can find one and give it a look. The worst thing, that can happen is that you throw it back up on Craigslist and get your money back. But
yeah, so one other thing, Wesley Finland wrote a great article on Tested.
That's right.
About just using CRTs for gaming. And he kind of goes into a lot of things like scan lines and everything else. It's a really, really wide topic and a very deep hole. But he did a pretty good job of kind of summarizing all of that and just, why do you want a CRT to do your gaming and what are those differences and what models to look for and everything else. So it's a really good recap. I think we can put maybe the link in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely. And like literally, I was on like the NeoGAF thread for just because I, did some stuff in there when I got my Framemeister and just was peeking around in there and having people just like reminding me that, you have to look for models with certain amounts of vertical lines. Like you want to make sure you get the maximum amount of actual lines of pixels on your monitor for the maximum picture quality. But yeah, those scan lines look effing awesome. Like it is just... It is super cool looking, but still spending too much money. I was able to get a Japanese Sega Saturn for really cheap that was local in the United States for like $35. So this is me asking you guys because you guys have delved into the Saturn stuff a lot more than I have. I have a very nice friend, Natsumi, who was willing enough and even able to get yelled at by shopkeepers in the local trader, getting kicked out of trader to go retro game shopping for me virtually via Facebook texting back and forth last week. So I was able to pick up a couple games like X-Men versus Street Fighter. And I think it was the Die Hard arcade game, Dynamite Deca. I think it's Deca.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And a couple other fighters, some cheaper games like the Virtual Cop games. But I was wondering for you guys, and Brandon, I'll throw it out to you first. What are some of like the hidden gems on the Sega Saturn, whether it be like U.S. games or Japanese games? Do you have anything that you would recommend for people to pick up if they're starting to get into the Sega Saturn now?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm curious to know how anyone would get kicked out of Trader.
She was taking pictures, and she went into all the stores, and she would take pictures of their games, and she would send them to me, and then I would crop out the games that I want and then send them back to her. And I guess in some of the stores, I remember seeing this like almost at a lot of stores, they actually have like signs that say no photos and stuff like that. So the lovely woman at Friends was very kind, and she took like 24 pictures there, but Trader, she took 6 pictures, got kicked out.
Yeah, well, you got to be real subtle when you're doing that stuff, because I do that all the time. I take photos so that I can remember what the prices are when I go to the other stores, because Akihabara is now a complete wasteland where everything is twice the price it was 3 years ago. And because mostly I would say that most of the Akihabara collection is now in the U.S. or Europe. It has all been taken away. Anyway, let's talk about Saturn. So some interesting things, let's say on the U.S. side, I think Amok is an interesting game. It's not great or anything. It's a very early game. The reason that it's interesting is it uses voxels for its terrain, and there are very few console games that have done this, and that's quite interesting, I think. Instead of actual polygons, they use voxels, and it looks super weird. There's Shin Shinobi Den, also known as Shinobi Legions, which is the kind of digitized graphic version of Shinobi, the last 2D Shinobi. And it looks pretty weird because people thought that those digitized movie graphics were a thing back then, but it actually plays quite nicely, and it's got a lot of cool environmental interaction that you don't have in the other Shinobis, and quite like that. Layer Section, also known as Galactic Attack in the US, it's Layer Section in Japan, is a really awesome 2D top-down shooter from Taito, which in the US it later was called Raystorm, like the PlayStation version of that, but this first one is sprite based, but it has a lot of crazy interesting things graphically with the sprites scaling and rotation, and it's got a neat mechanic of you can shoot straight at enemies that are on your level, or you can lock on with your laser to enemies that are below you, and that's pretty much all the game is. But it works really well. And G Darius is very good for Darius Gaiden. G Darius is something else. Mm-hmm. Darius Gaiden is really cool for similar reasons. If you like looking at big sprites doing interesting things, that's a good game. Astal is a strange 2D platformer from Sega that has a lot of cool stuff to it, but is super flawed, and it gets really difficult at some point because they for the US version, they reduced the number of hits you could take by 40%. So that makes it a lot harder, the US version. Japanese version is a lot easier. But it's another one of those kind of 2D showcases. It's got interesting music. It's got terrible voice acting in the US, just terrible. Another weird thing about it is in the sprite sheet, there's actually a Mario sprite in there for some reason that I guess maybe they were using for color checking or something. But it's an original Mario sprite, clearly by the team. You never see it in game, but it's on the sheet, which is really, really just bizarre.
This is getting expensive.
Yeah,
it is. I'm taking notes right now.
Most of these things that I've said are really cheap.
Yeah,
actually, Sonic Jam is a really cool one because you get all those Sonics, but also you get the bizarre 3D Sonic Overworld game where you can kind of go and look at some old Sonic lore and things like that. Because you walk into these movie theaters and you can look at commercials and you can look at release information for the older titles and stuff. But one thing that not very many people know, apparently, is that you can actually beat that. It's a game in itself that is beatable. So there are these little challenges where you can get a certain number of rings in a certain amount of time. And eventually, if you beat all of these challenges, then a big giant ring will show up in the sky. And if you can go jump into that, then it rolls credits. So it actually has a game itself that most people don't really know about. Another good one is Symphony of the Night. The Saturn version has an extra stage, the Something Garden. I don't remember. And it's got another song written by... what's her name, whose name I'm blanking on right now. But it's really good. You should also get all the Panzer Dragoon games because they are some of the best things on that console, and they just look fantastic too. Mm-hmm. Especially if you can, the crisper you can get the experience, like if you do it with S-Video on your PVM, it looks fantastic. The 3D that they did in that game is really excellent. I also like the last true kind of Sonic game. I guess Sonic Adventure was one as well. But the last true non-Sonic Sonic Team game is Burning Rangers. And they did some interesting stuff in that game. They wound up reappropriating the sound chip to make an alpha layer since they couldn't do... transparency regularly. The Saturn didn't have like innate transparency ability. They reappropriated the sound chip since it was the X68000 still, and used that to create an alpha layer for all the fire. So that I like when people do weird stuff like that, and the game is interesting as well.
Is that something I can play without knowing any Japanese? If I'm playing the Japanese version, I should say.
I forget. I think so. Like you gotta save people. You gotta follow your objectives. There's a map. Yeah, you gotta be fine.
I'm good at saving people. I can do that.
Yeah, excellent. Man, I could go on forever though. So I'll
yeah, Steve. What do you got? Okay, I'm literally taking notes and I'm like looking at prices on eBay. I'm like, all right, maybe I should wait until I'm back out in Japan.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Brandon covered pretty much the big list.
Yeah,
I think I'm trying to think of what he didn't mention. Assault Suits Lenos, which is good. It's a kind of like a follow up to Target Earth, I think. And Saturn Bomberman's a must. I mean, just,
oh yeah, I was going to mention that too.
Yeah, widescreen and having all the players. Sorry, go ahead, Brandon.
Yeah, if I can just jump in on Saturn Bomberman for a second, since we were talking about the TurboGrafx before. Mm-hmm. Just as an aside with Saturn Bomberman. It is the Saturn Bomberman is the legacy of the High 10. So there was a thing called High 10 Bomberman. It was the first HD game on the first HD screen in Japan. Hudson used to do a thing called the Caravan, where they would show new games all around Japan to kids before they came out. And there were some of the most expensive PC Engine games are from there, because they would give out these one-offs that were just Caravan versions. And High 10 Bomberman was 10-player widescreen HD Bomberman, HD for the time at least. And it then disappeared for a really long time. But the hardware that they made it on was the Iron Man board, which wound up becoming the PCFX. But then they wound up putting High 10 Bomberman into Saturn Bomberman. When you plug in 10 controllers, if you have enough multi-taps, which is 2, I guess, then you can actually play what is very close to the original High 10 Bomberman, and you can play it in 16:9 in relative HD. So you can kind of have that historical experience for yourself in Saturn Bomberman, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. I think at the time it's a 16x9 CRTs, right? Sony and some of those manufacturers are what you were playing on in Japan. Now, you kind of mentioned the big one, like, I totally agree with Layer Section, maybe like Batsugan.
Yeah.
For shooters, mm-hmm. There's Elevator Action Returns.
Mike had convinced me. I ordered that. I got a copy for like $65, which seems to be like way less than it seems to be going for, at least.
Yeah, odd things every once in a while just kind of jump up because people are like, oh, I remember Elevator Action. I didn't know there was a sequel or anything like that.
That game looks really – I just watched a YouTube video of it, and it has that like weird look of like cool, you know, polygonal 2D action that is like oddly violent.
Yeah.
for revisiting a classic arcade game, which is cool.
Yeah, but I think Brandon really gave you sort of the list to work off of. And once you chop that down, we'll probably add another 20.
Okay. Well, that's like $500 worth of stuff. So I'm going to cap it at that for right now. But that is for the listeners too. If you want to start getting into Sega Saturn stuff, like we've mentioned before, the last couple episodes of the podcast, like prices on not just this, not just TurboGrafx stuff, everything is going through the friggin' roof right now. And I don't know why that's happening, whether it just be people getting money that grew up with this stuff and they want to buy it again, or if it is stuff like the Retron 5 just causing people to say, all right, I bought this Retron 5 thing and now I need to go buy stuff for it. So
that's actually interesting you mentioned that, because at the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo, we definitely saw that, mm-hmm. With people who had bought a Retron 5 and were just piling up on loose carts. So we opened up a vendor table just to get rid of, you know, doubles and triples, mm-hmm. and we were selling out a loose Genesis and Super Nintendo because we were like, oh yeah, I can use this on the Retron, and all right, fine.
That's cool. I mean, it sucks that prices are going up, but I think it's really great that, you know, people are really digging this stuff, and there's so many games that as good of a job the Virtual Console or Nintendo can do with the Virtual Console, you know, and how, you know, games can get re-released on PSN or Xbox Live Arcade, there's just going to be too many games that either aren't going to be emulated or they aren't going to be re-released because of, you know, publishers and developers getting bought and sold and all that crap. So, it is what it is. Well, I think that is where we are going to wrap up for this episode. Otherwise, we're just going to talk forever about shopping, and I'm going to spend too much money that I cannot afford. So first off, thank you so much for you guys coming on the show. I mean, of course, Steve, you've been on a couple times. I don't know if you have anything coming up that you want people to check out. And obviously, people can follow you at Stephen P. Lin. You buying any other crazy like Nintendo documents soon?
I don't think so. I'm really in the process of getting rid of some of the arcade and pinball. It just got to be too many. Mm-hmm. So in that phase right now, but always on the lookout. You know, you have a one of a kind or a prototype or something, we'll definitely take a look. I'm talking with Frank and a couple other people about donating parts of my collection to places like the Strong and mm-hmm. Video Game History Museum. So there'll be some curation over the course of the next couple months.
Awesome. And Brandon, for yourself, anything that people should keep a lookout for? And of course, they can follow you at Necrosofty with a Y at the end on Twitter.
Yeah. Let's see. I guess I got my games that you can kind of look at that are sort of starting to come out. I've got a game called Gunhouse out for PlayStation Mobile, which you could theoretically purchase if you could find the place on the store on the Vita, if you own a Vita. That would be interesting. And I've got a game called Gunsport, which is coming out in the future, but we're gonna be saying a whole lot more stuff about that game in the next few months. We should be announcing it properly in a couple weeks or so. And another game you can anticipate is a game called Oh Dear, which kind of looks like Outrun 1, plays like Outrun 2, and it's about hitting as many or as few deer with your station wagon as possible.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, of course, everyone out there, we'll have links for stuff, all the stuff mentioned in the show notes. It's going to be a very deep show notes for this episode. But in terms of Back in My Play stuff, just a quick programming note. I think the next game that we're going to do is RoboCop versus Terminator on the Sega Genesis with Greg Seward. And I just got recently, all right, like I said, I got that Twin Famicom, and I finally been able to play a copy of Mighty Final Fight that I've had for a while. And that game is freaking awesome. Like, that game needs to be talked about. So maybe we'll be doing that soon. And then Kurt Collada is going to be coming back on to complete the Castlevania episodes that we've been doing with Bloodlines on the Sega Genesis. And then Phil Theobald is going to be coming up to talk about Mega Man X and try to convince me that that is fun to play. And hopefully, I can replay that and find something to really enjoy in that game. But like I said, the best way to support us right now is to go to iTunes, submit a review on there. That is the best thing that you can do. And also, we just relaunched new t-shirts at teespring.com/backinmyplaytri, all one word, because now they got those awesome tri-blend t-shirts. I'm wearing my Japanese console version right now. They are very comfortable and only $17, which is not too bad to wear a shirt that has an NES and a Sega Genesis and a Super Nintendo on it. Unfortunately, we cannot fit the Turbo graphics on there. It was a little bit too wide, but the PC Engine core is on the Japanese version of the shirt, so you can always grab that. But yeah, guys, thank you so much for coming on. It was really cool to get some insider insight into Bonk's Revenge. And of course, both of you guys are always welcome back on the show. I hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks, yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
All right, take care, everyone. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.